With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Bobby called. He's coming to California. He wants to see me. Drawing on secret police files, Marilyn Monroe's private diary, and never-before-published first-hand testimony, this book proves that Robert Kennedy was directly responsible for her death. It details the legendary star's tumultuous personal involvement with him and his brother, President John Kennedy, and how they sought to silence her. The new evidence and testimony is provided by Mike Rothmiller, who, as a detective of the Organized Crime Intelligence Division, OCID, of the LAPD, had direct personal access to hundreds of secret LAPD files on exactly what happened at Marilyn Monroe's California home on August 5, 1962. With his training and investigator's knowledge, Rothmiller used that secret information to get to the heart of the matter, to the people who were there the night Marilyn died, two of whom played major roles in the cover-up and the wider conspiracy to protect the Kennedys at all costs. There'll be those with doubts, but to them, the lawman who directed international intelligence operations targeting organized crime says the printed, forensic, and oral evidence are totally convincing. He insists, if I presented my evidence in any court of law, I'd get a conviction. The book we're featuring this evening is Bombshell, The Night Bobby Kennedy Killed Marilyn Monroe, with my special guest, historian, author, and former detective Mike Rothmiller. Welcome back to the program, and thank you so much for this interview, Mike Rothmiller.
Good evening. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much for this incredible opportunity to speak to you about Bombshell. Let's start as you do in this book and give us a background on you joined the LAPD, Los Angeles Police Department in 1972. Tell us how you came to be involved with the OCID, the Organized Crime Intelligence Division.
Sure. As you mentioned, I entered the police academy in 72, and then I worked patrol for maybe about 3 years. I became a patrol training officer, and I moved to a new division, and I entered Vice undercover for 18 months, and during Vice, we worked Hollywood, which was very strange, Vice activity there, and other parts of the city, and when I was working Vice, two guys from OCID, two detectives, came out and started talking to us. And quite frankly, I didn't know what OCID did. I know what it said in the police manual. It says they investigate organized crime. That was it. But what they really did, I had no idea. And so we were talking one day, and I happened to arrest the guy who had a just a bookmaking warrant out for his arrest. And as it turned out, when I started interrogating him, he was one of the shooters in a contract killing. And for some reason, he decided to lay this out. And it was an organized crime killing on the Pasadena Freeway. What happened, there was a woman involved in the car that he was driving, a guy with the shotgun in the back seat, and they pull up next to this car. He fires out the window, shoots the guy in the head with the shotgun, and kills him. And a little side note on that, the guy who actually did the shooting was the Maytag repairman in that city where I was at. During the day, he would repair washers and dryers, and at night he was carrying out contract killing. So anyway, this guy lays it all out, and we had some other people arrest them for murder and so forth. And I had taken the detective exam and scored very high on it, so I knew within a month or two I was going to be promoted. And they told me, they said, hey, there's an opening in OCID coming up. Why don't you apply? I said, sure, why not? Otherwise, they assign you somewhere. And I went down, took the interview with the captain and the lieutenants. And there was roughly 100 guys applied for it. And I was the youngest by age. And I hadn't been promoted to detective yet. And the rest of them were all detectives. They'd been for years. And for some reason, the captain selected me. I went into OCID. And that's when I got my first taste of what really was going on within that division. And I started going through the files, the file cabinets, and you gotta remember there's these huge file cabinets with index cards because we didn't have computers. And right. There are probably a good 40 to 50,000 cards in there, different people, their index cards, which meant all of them had either one or hundreds or thousands of intelligence reports written on them. And each card is linked to other ones, their associates, relatives, or whatever it may be. So when I was going through it, I came across a lot of politicians, and I thought that was rather interesting, including the mayor at the time of Los Angeles, who was a former L.A. cop. And I looked at it. There was nothing criminal. It was just surveillance of him, who he met with, and so forth. So I started jumping through the files, and I found came across the Kennedys, John Kennedy, primarily I looked at first. And it was massive, the dossier they had on him. And his was linked to Robert Kennedy, Edward Kennedy, Marilyn Monroe, and also Peter Lawford, among some organized crime people. So I started pulling those files out of curiosity, and I started reading them. And as I was going through these files, I started realizing that, wait a minute, some of the stuff that I've heard in the past regarding Marilyn Monroe is not true. I know what the official story was, but these files were telling me something completely different. And the intelligence files are always accurate because there's no spin placed on them. So I continued reading those files over a period of months and maybe years on and off, and I started finding file on a guy named Fred Otash. And Fred Otash was the person who placed the wiretaps on Marilyn's house and on Peter Lawford's house. He also planted bugs in their house, listening devices. And I started reading about that, and I saw some of the transcripts of these conversations Peter Lawford was having with Robert Kennedy and John Kennedy and Marilyn Monroe and so forth. And I looked up Fred, and he was still around. He was in Los Angeles, and so I got in contact with him, and over a period of time, I developed him as an informant. And the reason I did that, because he was operating, one day he was acting as a criminal, white-collar crime, the next day he wasn't. And so the people he ran with in the criminal world were the ones I was interested in, so he was an ideal person to have as an informant. And I started talking to Fred, and finally one day we got together, and I confronted him on this. I started quizzing him about the 1960s, the early 60s, because that's when he was very active in doing this. And he was very accurate. His memory hadn't failed. He was detailed. But I also caught him in a couple of direct lies. And when I called him on it, he admitted that he was BSing me. And so then he started telling the truth. So as this conversation went on, and over the months, I said, okay, Fred, who hired you to place these wiretaps and bugs starting in Peter Lawford's house? I said, what happened there? Who hired you? And he said, well, when I planted a bug in his office, in his home office, he said, that was Peter asked me to do that. And I said, well, why? He says, well, because Peter's holding meetings in there and negotiations on whatever. And he said Peter would have the conversation and he would excuse himself, go into the next room, then listen in to what was being said. I said, okay, right. That makes sense. A lot of business people have done that. And I said, okay, now how about the wiretap on his phone? He says, well, he says, when I was there installing the wire, the bugs in his house, Fred being Fred, he said, I installed a wiretap on his phone for his personal use. Well, Fred was supplying loads of information to the scandal sheets then in Los Angeles and other places, the inside information on movie stars and that stuff. So he right. did that so he could sell that information. And he said as time went by, not a lot of time, a short period of time, he said he was contacted by the CIA, and they asked for the information that he was receiving on the wiretaps and bugs. And he said also Jimmy Hoffa's agent came to him, same thing, they won. So he says, over a period of months, he was being paid by Jimmy Hoffa, the CIA, the FBI, and LAPD Organized Crime Unit to give him that information that he was gathering on wiretaps and so forth. So he did, but he said, finally what happened was the Hoffa and the CIA, they wanted a lot of stuff on Kennedy, on the Kennedy brothers. So he installed the wiretap in Marilyn's house and the bug in her house. And I asked him, how did you do that? How did you get into her house to do this? And he said, well, he had a couple guys from the phone company on his payroll. They just cut off the telephone service to Marilyn's house. Then they went over there and said, we know you don't have telephone service. We're here to repair it. And Marilyn wasn't there, so the housekeeper said, great, come on in and do sure. it. So when they did that, they installed the wiretap and they installed the bugs in the house. So he was dishing out this information to the various agencies. He said he gave Hoffa very little because Hoffa was a hothead, and he was afraid he would go public and then he would find himself in a bind. So mm-hmm. the main players that he gave to were the other agencies, the FBI, CIA, but he said he swore he gave everything to OCID, which I didn't believe, but I asked him why, and he said, well, because you guys are the hometown team. He lived in L.A., and he says, I know what you guys can do to me. And he says, I don't want any trouble from you. So he says, I gave all my information to OCID. So that's how it started coming about, and I kept digging more and more through the LAPD files. I started finding more about Fred and his wiretapping and information, the transcripts. And then what was really curious is that as I dug in deeper in the files, I came across a copy of her diary, which mm-hmm. was interesting because I always thought, as I'd heard from everybody else, it was lost, it was gone, nobody knows what happened to it. Well, right. LAPD Intelligence had a copy of it. And it was titled Marilyn Monroe's Diary, and I just started flipping through it. It was a Xerox copy of it, I should say. And I start flipping through it, and I see this is her. She's talking about people she knew. But what I did at the time is when I went through it, if she made some comment about somebody I didn't know, I've never heard the name. She just said, like, I'm going over to Larry's house for dinner, or so-and-so has nice roses in the garden, something like that. I didn't pay attention to because I didn't know what she's talking about. But when she came to the point of talking about Peter Lawford, the Kennedys, mainly Jack and Robert, I noticed that, and I knew who she was talking about because she one time said the president, and she said Jack and John, blah, 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 and Robert. And I took notes of those right at the time. I just started making copies, writing down what she's saying. And I've had those all these years, and those appear in the book. But she got into talking about her feelings regarding the president and Robert Kennedy. She talks about having sex with the president and how he gave her a pill one time, which was probably a sedative of some type. But she just goes on talking about the type of sex he liked, and she wasn't that thrilled about it, but she did it anyway. So the diary gets into that. It talked about that, which is all in the book. And then she talked about her relationship with Robert Kennedy, and which, once again, all her comments are in the book. But it appears that she actually fell in love with Robert Kennedy. And she did think, apparently, that he was going to leave his wife and they were going to get together, which never would have happened. But as time went by, when JFK, because I read the intelligence document, when he was caught on a wiretap by the feds, the FBI, talking to a few mob people and also talking to Maryland, Hoover went to Robert, or had Robert come to him, I should say, and said, "Here, listen to these. It's your brother talking to so-and-so. We know what he's doing. And, you know, just want to let you know." And so that was Hoover blackmailing JFK. And what the intelligence indicates is that Robert told his brother, and that's when he broke off the relationship with Marilyn. And she was upset, but also what happens, Robert was kind of the middleman there to smooth things over, to keep her calm, keep her happy, and he started having an affair with her. Then, as time went by, she started calling DOJ, where Robert was the attorney general. She started calling the White House, and nobody was returning her calls, and she was getting pissed off. And that is verified by what Fred Otash knew from his recordings and from what it basically says in her diary and the other intelligence documents. And so Peter Lawford was then called to go over and try to calm Marilyn down. This was, you know, a couple weeks before her death. And he was trying his best, but she wasn't having any of it. And she said, "No, I want them, you know, talk to me. I don't like being treated like basically a whore and being tossed around." And so Peter found himself in a difficult position. He was trying to be middleman and soothe both sides, and it wasn't working. So she did, because I read the transcript, she did threaten to go public with the information of her having an affair with John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy.
Right.
And Peter, she told Peter that, and Peter immediately got a hold of them and said, you know, "Hey, she's on the verge of going public and blowing up, and she wants to talk to Robert, and he won't talk to her." And so finally, Peter talked him into coming over and seeing her. And in her diary, she mentions that Bobby was coming over. And so he flies in, Robert flies in, Peter picks him up at the airport. He flew in a private plane and takes him to his house. At his house, he has a telephone call from JFK. Robert's talking to JFK from Peter's house. Then they talk with Marilyn a couple of times, Peter does. They go up there to her house that afternoon. He says they try to make everything amenable, but she wasn't going for it. And so they leave, and he says he speaks to her a couple more times, and via telephone, Peter does, and she agrees to let them come up that night. So they go up that night, and they're meeting with her again. And I said, "Well, who is at the house?" And he says, "There's nobody there, just Marilyn, Peter, and Robert Kennedy." And I said, "Okay, what happened?" So he goes into his first version. Well, pardon me, let me back up. I'm got ahead of myself. I met Peter Lawford at the Playboy Mansion prior to this meeting with him. I went up there on a weekend because we had access to the Playboy Mansion working intelligence, and I took my wife and a couple of friends just to have a tour. In this room, mm-hmm. I see this haggard old guy watching a TV set, and I thought it was kind of strange. And he looked at me. Then I realized who it was Peter Lawford. He looked pretty haggard, and he was either a combination of drugs and alcohol, but he was just pretty much out of it. I talked to him briefly for a second. He just kind of nodded. I shoved a business card of mine in his shirt pocket. My wife and the friends come over. Oh, hello, Miss Lawford. Hi. He just kind of nods, and then we go about our business. Well, when I'm at the office the next time, I get a call from him, and he didn't remember meeting me, and he just said, hey, I found this card in my pocket, and I don't know what it's for or why I got it. And I started talking to him about it. I said, well, I met you at the Floyd Boyd Mansion and so forth, and I would like to talk to you about some historic events that happened to Hollywood during the late 50s and 60s. And he said, okay. And then he goes, are you with the CIA? Which was a very strange question. And I said, no, I work LAPD intelligence. And he goes, okay. And he says, well, what do you want to talk about? And I said, well, just some old historic stuff, you know, just get together and chat. Because I didn't want to tell him what it was over the phone. And then he says again, he says, are you sure you're not the CIA? And I said, yes, I am not the CIA. So it was rather strange that he was asking me if I was the CIA, but we agreed to meet up in a park the following day, not far from the Playboy Mansion. I go up there. I'm waiting and waiting. About an hour later, he hasn't shown. I'm ready to leave. Then I finally spot him walking in the park. I go over and talk to him, and he doesn't remember me seeing me. We sit down on the bench, and he says, well, what do you want? And I said, well, I just want to talk to you about the past. So I started quizzing him, which you always do on people like that, about their memory. And I started quizzing him about the 50s, late 50s and 60s, Hollywood and what he was doing and so forth with the Kennedys. And he was accurate, and he wasn't drunk, and he wasn't under the influence of drugs or anything at the time. And he was very accurate and detailed. And so I said, okay, I just want you to clear up something regarding Marilyn Monroe's death. And that I can just see he stiffened up instantly.
Right.
And he says, what? And I said, well, I just want to hear your story. So he proceeded to tell me the story that was scripted for him with LAPD's assistance, LAPD intelligence, way back when. And I knew that was BS. And so I told him, said that, I just left him, said, Peter, that's not true. That's a lie that was given you by LAPD. And he got a little upset about that. And he stood up and he was ready to leave. And I stood up. And at that point, I knew I had to move it from a simple interview to a hostile interrogation, which is a difference in the way they're handled and what you do. So
sure.
I got up and I started getting on him, getting in his face, and basically telling him, no, you're going to tell me what happened, what really happened. You're not going to give me that line of so-and-so that you've been given for years. I said, I want to know what happened. And then I got into it. I said, you know, Bobby's dead. Jack is dead. Marilyn's dead. Everybody's dead but you, who knew anything about it. And I said, I just want you to clear it up, and I'm not coming after you. Nobody's coming after you. I said, but, you asked me a lot about the CIA and so forth, and I said, you know, there are a lot of people who would want to know what you would be telling me, and just meeting with me is going to put some fear into them about what you may have said. So I
right.
said, this is your chance. Tell me now what happened. Or forget it. You know, you may find yourself in a position you don't want to be. So he looked at me, and then he sat down on the bench. And I sat down next to him again, and he just cradled his face in his hands, and he was just quiet. Then he just said, what do you want to know? And I just said, tell me the truth, what happened. So at that stage, he opened up, and it just started flowing out. And it was rather interesting because in the past when I interrogated people that were carrying a huge burden of guilt, when they start relieving it, unloading that, you can see it in them. And it's just, it's really an interesting transformation to watch. So he just started unloading. And I knew he was telling me the truth because I read all the intelligence on it. So he was just going through it, what happened, and what went on in the house. And I said, okay, well, now you're at the house that night. What happened? He says, well, I'm just going to paraphrase everything, make it shorter than what's in the book, but is that Robert and Marilyn got in a huge, huge argument, and to the point where he thought she was going to slap him. Robert pushed her down onto the ground. They were screaming at each other. So he says he had to break them up. He pulled Robert back, and Marilyn got up, and they're just a screaming contest going on. So he says he kind of calmed Marilyn down some. Then he and Robert start searching the house and going into the bedroom and so forth and pulling out dresser drawers and looking through there. And he says when Robert was doing the dresser drawer, Marilyn came up and grabbed him, screaming at him. He pushed her down again on the floor and then grabbed her by the wrist, and they were just a true screaming match. And so he was definitely afraid, Peter was. He said that it was warm, the windows in the house were open. He was afraid the neighbors were going to hear the screaming, the argument, and call the police. He was definitely afraid of that. So he says this continued, and finally he was able to shuttle Marilyn into the living room and sat her down on the sofa. He sat next to her, and he's holding her, and he's just talking, trying to calm the situation down. Robert keeps quizzing her, asking her some questions, which, well, once again, that's all in the book. But anyway, Robert then leaves the room, and he goes into the kitchen, and Peter waits a few minutes. He doesn't come back. He said it's only a few minutes, and he walks in to see what he's doing. And he said he walks in, and he's got what appeared to be a clear glass goblet thing with clear water in it, and he's got a spoon in it, and he's stirring it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I asked him, well, what color was the water? He said, oh, it just was clear, but he had a spoon in there. And I said, okay, you don't put a spoon in water, you know, stir it. So I said, what did he put in it? He says, well, I don't know. I thought it was a sedative or something. And I said, okay. And then what happened? He says, well, then they walked back into the living room, and Marilyn's still on the sofa crying, and he offers her, says, here, take a drink, you'll feel better. She didn't want it, and then Peter was coaxing. He says, no, go ahead, drink it, you'll feel better. And he thought it was just perhaps a simple sedative that helped calm her down. And so she sipped it. She complained of the taste. They pushed her a little bit more. She drank more. And they just kept talking. And he says, Robert walked back into the kitchen with the glass. He says, then he continued searching the house. He says, then he went, followed Robert, once again left Marilyn on the sofa. And he says, they were gone. He said he wasn't sure how long they were gone searching part of the house. But he said when they came back in, Marilyn was still on the sofa with her head tilted back. And she looked like she was sleeping or just out of it because of the drugs.
Mm-hmm.
So they continued looking around. Then when they were coming back in, they heard a knock at the door. And Peter said he pretty much panicked at that stage because he just felt that it had to be the police coming or a neighbor coming to see what's going on. And he said nobody said anything. He said Robert didn't say anything. Peter didn't say anything, but Peter said, I walked around, I looked at her, and she was waxen looking. And most people, if you've seen them right after they die, that's pretty much how they look. And I said, was she breathing? He said, I don't think so. I said, did you think maybe she was dead? He says, yeah. And Bobby just says, we got to go. Takes him by the arm, leads to the front door, and he's saying, well, what about Marilyn, you know? And he says, go, let's go. They open the door, and he says, he looks, and there's two men standing there in plain clothes. And he says, nobody said a word. He said, they didn't say anything. He said, Bobby didn't say anything. He says, and they just stepped back, and we walked out, and Bobby just said, we got to go, and went to the car. And he said, I looked back and saw these guys enter the house and close the door. So I said, well, do you know who they were? And he said, no, not really. And I said, I don't know their names. And I said, have you ever seen either one of them before? He says, yeah, the one guy I've seen before. And I said, in what context? And he says, well, before John Kennedy became president and before Robert was in the office, he says, this guy was a friend of theirs. And he says, I know he's a cop. He says, and what happened is the two brothers are individually, they'd come out to L.A., and this guy would act as their chauffeur and bodyguard and procure right. women for him and so forth. And at that point, it clicked in my head who the person was. And so I said, you've seen him before. I said, would you recognize the name if you heard it? And he said, I don't know. And I said, was the guy's name last name Hamilton? And he goes, that's it. That's the guy. Well, Hamilton was the captain of the intelligence division and a very longtime friend of Robert and Jack Kennedy. And so he's the one that went into the house. Well, then as Peter's taking him to the airport, they were stopped by a Beverly Hills cop and for speeding, and he went on, and Robert went back up, flew secretly back up to Central California. And I asked him, I said, well, why did you ever hear why there was a delay in calling the police when Marilyn died? And he said, well, you know, I heard stories internally. I said, what? And he says, well, to give him time to get out of L.A., meaning Robert. I said, so basically to build an alibi. And he goes, yeah, yeah. I asked him also if he thought that they, meaning the Kennedys, wanted her dead, and he just basically nodded, you know, affirming that he did. But he also said, he said, he felt, if, to me, it was obvious he felt terrible about this, and he said, but they didn't have to do it. They didn't have to do it. And which they didn't have to do it. There are other ways would have been available to handle her at the time. But then was interesting, in 93 after my first book, it was about 93 after my first book was out, L.A. Secret Police, I get a call from a guy named Jack Clemens. And I said, okay, who are you, Jack? You know, I don't know. I didn't know him. And he said, well, you know, I was LAPD, blah, 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 a certain amount of time. And he says, I was the first guy, first LAPD cop at Marilyn's home the night she died. He was the watch commander. He took the call and he went up there. And I said, okay. That's fine. What then? And he said, well, I want to get together with you and tell you what happened. Okay. You know, I was already out of law enforcement by that time. I had already been doing a television show and everything. And I got together with him, and I said, well, what do you want to tell me? So he says, well, you know, there was a huge cover-up. They tried to get me involved in it. And I knew there was a cover-up, obviously. And I said, okay, well, tell me your story. And he went on and said, well, the night I got there, he said, everything was being staged. And he says, it was staged before I got there. And he says, but I couldn't prove it at that time. But he said, about a week later, he's at the station where he's working. And he says, these two guys come in. And he says, they identify themselves from OCID. And he says, they talked to me, and they said, here, we want you to sign this report. It's called a 15-7. Basically, he would write out what he saw and did that night and turn it in. And he read it, and he said, I didn't write this. And he said he read it further. He says, and this didn't happen this way. This is BS. I'm not going to sign this. And he said, no, you're going to sign it. And he said, no, I'm not. So then at that stage, he said, the one guy pulls out his ID, and guess who it is? Captain Hamilton, right, ordering him to sign it. And he said, I'm not going to sign it. I don't care who you are. He said, Chief of Police can't make me sign this. So he says, they move on to the next subject. He said, okay, well, what we want you to do is look at these photographs. And what they were death scene photographs of the house and so forth, but primarily the ones of Marilyn Bed. And they said, we want you to sign, initial these. Well, that's completely out of LAPD protocol. When there's a photograph of a crime scene, the photographer has their name on it, not some cop that was there. And he's looking at these photographs, 8x10, black and whites, and one, he says, this is the second one they showed him. It showed Marilyn in bed, and most people have seen her. She's laying in bed holding a telephone receiver.
Right.
And he says, the next one they show me, it's the same picture, but she doesn't have the telephone receiver in her hand. Now, you look at that, and as a cop, you instantly know, wait a minute, they're altering evidence, they're staging this.
Mm-hmm.
But for one reason, he didn't know at the time. He refused to initial those. He says, no, I'm not going to do it. Forget it. So that was pretty much his death knell. And they ran him out of the PD a short time later. And the other thing that was interesting is in about the same time, about 93, 94, I was doing a radio talk show about my book. And two of the guys that are on the line with me is Sam Yorty, who was the mayor at the time, and Tom Redden, who was a deputy chief when she died, and he later became chief of police. So we're chatting about it, and both of them asked me when we went to a commercial, I said, can I call you? I want to talk to you. Fine, I gave my number. Yorty calls me the next day, and I said, yeah, well, what do you want to talk about? And he says, well, I want to know about Marilyn Monroe, what the truth is, because he says, Parker, who was the chief then, he says, he just lied to me on so many things. And I said, okay, so I tell him what I knew, and he goes, okay. And I said, now, do you want to know what was in your file? Because he had a massive intelligence file, OCID maintained on him. And I said, do you want to know what's in your file? He says, no. He didn't want to hear it.
Yeah.
And so that was the end of our conversation. Tom Wren calls me several days later. And we're talking, and he says, same question. He says, would you please tell me what really happened with Marilyn Monroe? And I go, what? And I said, you were the chief of police. You were the deputy chief when this happened. You were in Parker's office. What are you talking about? He says, well, here's what happened. He says, yeah, I was the deputy chief. And he says, when Captain Hamilton came in, because Hamilton also went to the phone company and pulled all of the records on Marilyn Monroe's telephone calls, he brought them in, gave them to Chief Parker, and Redden was in Parker's office when he delivered those, and they all went over them. He says, and Parker took those telephone tolls, put them in his personal safe, and that was the end of it. You know, he says, we just didn't talk about it anymore. So Redden ends up down the line becoming chief of police. And he tells me, he says, the first thing I did, the first day I was chief, I got into the office, he says, I called OCID. And he says, the guy who answered, he says, I think he was a lieutenant, I'm not quite sure, he says, I don't remember. But he says, I asked him, I said, do you guys have any files, intelligence files, on Marilyn Monroe, Peter Lawford, the Kennedys? And the guy said, well, yes, we do, chief, you know. Certainly we do. And he says, fine, get all those files together, bring them to my office this afternoon. I want to see them. Sure, you got it. Well, he says, that afternoon comes, and the captain from OCID comes in carrying nothing. And he says, well, I understand you wanted to talk about the Kennedys and Monroe, this chief. And he says, no, I want to see the files. And the captain says, we don't have any files on them. And Redden says, I knew he was lying, but he says, the way that OCID had a filing system, which I know this to be a fact, he says, I could have went down there and spent months and never found anything that I was looking for.
Right.
Because there was a code that we had internally in intelligence. And he said, I also knew that the files would be hidden quickly. Just pull them out, take them out, and put them in the trunk of a car, and they don't exist anymore. So he says, I knew I was being lied to even when I was chief. So he said, that's what I want to know from you, what really happened. So I laid it out to him, and he said he was not surprised by hearing it, all the details and so forth. So,
Mike? Yes.
Yes.
Mike, let's use as an opportunity to stop just for a second for our sponsor. If you're a business owner who's hiring, you probably face a lot of challenges when it comes to finding the right person for your role, like not enough applicants with the right skills or experience, or too many resumes to sort through, yet you need to hire as soon as possible, or not knowing where to post your job to reach the right people. That's why hiring can feel like trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/murder. When you post a job on ZipRecruiter, it gets sent to over 100 top job sites with one click. Then ZipRecruiter's matching technology finds people with the right skills and experience for your job and actively invites them to apply. In fact, ZipRecruiter was so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. It's no wonder over 2.3 million businesses have come to ZipRecruiter for their hiring needs. So while other companies overwhelm you with way too many options, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for, the needle in the haystack. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at this web address, ZipRecruiter.com/murder. Once again, remember to go to this unique place, ZipRecruiter.com/M-U-R-D-E-R. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Now, Mike, we were just talking about this information that you were asked by the, incredibly, the chief of police in L.A.
Right.
So continue with what else they gained from the conversation with you about this case and what you knew from being an OCID.
Sure. Well, what I told the chief was what I knew, which was basically the truth of what happened. And I already heard everything from Jack Clemens and so forth, so I just laid out the facts to him what went down that night. He knew, as did Parker, and later on when I was working as Daryl Gase's chief, everybody knew that Robert Kennedy secretly came to town. And part of the reason they knew that is because they had him under surveillance when he came to the airport, and Peter Lawford picked him up. OCID was surveilling them, and I saw some surveillance photographs taken that day during daylight hours of those two guys together when he was supposed to be up in Central California. So it wasn't a huge secret within the intelligence guys that he was
right
there that day, and they went up to Marilyn's house and so forth, and what happened. What is real interesting is that keeping this in context, what people have to know is that of the 60 detectives that were in there in organized crime, when I was there, in the 5 years, we never made one arrest, not one.
Wow.
And for anything. And the reason being, we were mandated just to gather intelligence. And the reason that was done is because if we made an arrest and we went to court and there was a subpoena served for records and so forth, they're going to have a difficult time explaining illegal a history of illegal wiretaps, black bag jobs, break-ins, other intimidating sort of things that went on with people. And they didn't want that. They just wanted the chief just wanted the intelligence. So that's what was done. And also, what's very important to understand is that in the history of OCID, well, it started as the gangster squad in 1932, and it went on to change names a few times, but it was always doing the same stuff, is that whenever, if you want to say a celebrity or notable person, whoever it was, died in a bizarre way, mainly looking at a homicide in Los Angeles or Southern California, two things would happen. And this happened in Marilyn Monroe. It happened with Bugsy Siegel, the mobster. It also handled a Robert. They handled in the same way Robert Kennedy, and that is the homicide unit, which would have been robbery homicide. They handle the criminal investigation. They handle going to court, testifying, and all that stuff. Well, while they're doing their investigation, OCID, or the intelligence unit, what it was called back then too, is that they do an intelligence investigation. Except the difference is two mainfold. One is that they don't follow the rules. They just did what they wanted, wiretaps, break-ins, so forth. And they never shared the information with the homicide guys that are really doing the case. The homicide guys never knew what the intelligence guys were doing. And so they did that on those particular cases. And they did that on Maryland's, and that's one of the files that I read was the intelligence investigation, which basically told a story that was never released. And those files still are locked up. They'll never be released if they still have them, if somebody hasn't destroyed them or taken them. But under the California Freedom of Information Act, you can't get them. I tried getting some a few years ago, just on, not on this case, but on cases that I worked, where I initiated the intelligence operation. I wrote about it in all the reports. I closed it, and it was done. I got a hold of LAPD. I filed with them for it, and they just came back and said, no, under California law, blah, blah, blah. Those are all considered active investigations. So right. We don't have to disclose anything. And sure. It was really kind of humorous because I asked them, one, I said, well, now the cases on, and I named off three organized crime guys who were killed in the 40s and 50s. And right. When I talked to a guy, he said, well, who were they? And I told him. He says, well, no, those are still active investigations. I said, the guy has been dead for 70 years. How could it be an active investigation? Everybody around him, the family, they're all dead. Under state law, those are active investigations, so we don't release anything. So that's the situation. They conducted all these investigations. They did the same with the Black Dahlia murder. I knew a guy who worked intelligence who was on the Black Dahlia murder case as an intelligence guy, and they did things that were so far out of the norm and illegal even at the time, most people would be stunned by it. But they also learned, the intelligence guys, who actually killed the Black Dahlia. They knew. They uncovered that. And it went so far as that they kidnapped him for over a week, trying to get him to confess, but he wouldn't. But they knew it was him. And they eventually had to cut him loose. But all of that stuff is locked up. And we'll never see the light of day.
You talk about the OCID, and you write in this book about the connections and the surveillance on people, celebrities like Frank Sinatra, which is crucial to this story as well, being a friend of Marilyn Monroe. You say having had sex with Marilyn Monroe and part of this rat pack that included Peter Lawford. But it was interesting that it's supposed to be organized crime, but there was much more emphasis on celebrity. But in that emphasis on the celebrities that they surveyed, there was always an organized crime connection, wasn't there?
In many cases, there were, but sometimes they were stretched. Like Sinatra, it's no secret today, he had some connections. But some of the other celebrities, Jack Lemmon, he was one there's a huge file on. And the reason being is that one day when he came into LAX, because there's always a squad of OCID guys at LAX watching who's coming and going on the aircrafts, the various planes. And so he came in, and some people came up to him, introduced to say, oh, hello, Mr. Lynn, blah, blah, blah. And what happened, there was a pseudo low-level mob guy, mob associate, say, who was flying to Vegas. And he walked up to him and shook hands, and that was it. Jacqueline didn't know who this guy was and walked away. But that was enough to justify putting Lemon in file and completing a full dossier on him and monitoring everything you could on him from that day forward. And so that's what they did with politicians. Sometimes that wasn't even a connection, a weak connection like that. It was just a matter of so-and-so is mayor, so-and-so is governor. As an example, Jerry Brown, when he was governor the first time in California, I was involved with some surveillances when he would come from Los Angeles. And you have to remember, there are no cell phones. They just had, a few people have radio phones in their cars. He had one as the governor. And there was an OCID associate who was more of an informant, and he was able to intercept all of Jerry Brown's telephone calls when he made it from the car. And so he would give those to OCID. Here's what the governor's talking about, who he's talking to, and all this stuff. OCID didn't complain because it was intelligence. But what was interesting is that Daryl Gates he just absolutely hated gays.
Right.
And if he thought any cop was gay or even got close, he'd fire them, he'd have them fired. But anyway, he thought over 10,000% that Jerry Brown was gay. So we had to set up information gathering to try to prove that he was gay. And it went so far as that there's some sort of little publication made some comment about Brown going down meeting with this attorney who was gay in Mississippi. And because of that, Gates sent his number one OCID guy, who only gathered information on politicians, down to Mississippi to try to get the information to prove that Brown was gay so he could blackmail him with it. He never got anything, but he was trying desperately. Also on John Vandecap was the district attorney in L.A., then he became the AG of California. And I was working on this guy who was an organized crime figure from Chicago. He lived in Laguna Beach, California. And the FBI had a pen register on his phone, which shows telephone numbers that are called and come in. Well, going through it from this beach house, this mob guy called that number, but it lasted for about 15 to 20, 30 seconds. So it was apparently a wrong number, because the number following that on this list the FBI gave us was one digit off. So the guy hung up, calls that number, and chats for about a half hour. So we knew it was just probably a misdial. Well, that went up to Gates' office. Gates learned about it in the intelligence briefing, and he ordered us to immediately go down to this beach house and start running surveillances on it, because Laguna Beach was known as a gay enclave then. And Gates said, if he's got a house there, he's got to be gay. I want you guys to prove it. Find out. And we're going, hey, we looked at the property. The house had been in their family for decades. And we said, you know, there's nothing to it. So we got permission to, if we wanted to rent a yacht to anchor it off the beach so we can watch it and not be conspicuous. But we went down there. I was running surveillance, and I just said, this is nuts. Just as crazy. And so I walked over to the house. It was on the beachfront, and I looked at it, and it was covered with cobwebs and spiderwebs and leaves and debris all around the front door, the entry door. Nobody had been there probably in months, if not a year or so. So we went back, reported that to the captain. Hey, this is just a waste of time, so forth. He talks to Gates about it, and Gates just said, no, keep an eye on that guy, Vandecap, because I want to know if he's gay, and I want to have the evidence. And because, once again, Gates was into doing what J. Edgar Hoover did, and that is blackmailing people to get them to do what he wanted. And that's what OCID was doing. We were gathering information on people like that. The news media, they were a big target for us. We ran surveillances on, it was Shelby Coffey who headed the LA Times. He's the editor. Their surveillances run on him. He was watched every time he went to LAX and what flights he went on and came in on. as was Lute Wasserman, the head of MCA at the time, and anybody like that, any politician. We would go to the airport crew, they would read all the rosters, who was coming up, coming in or going out on any flights, especially on Western Airlines, going to Vegas, and it was all reported to the chief, because that's what he wanted. But it was a complete invasion of everybody's privacy, as you can imagine, but that's what LAP intelligence had been doing for decades, literally decades.
This secret police elite unit you talk about, you also talk about just the police culture itself of people telling on others, telling those secrets, divulging those secrets. Do you mind telling us just what happened in this assassination attempt and also just how you feel about its possible connection with what you know and what you were going to divulge?
Yeah. A couple things. One, I've never been able to remove the possibility that the assassination attempt on me was because of what I was digging into regarding Marilyn Monroe. I could never remove that. I was involved in a number of intelligence operations at the time, including one with the commanding general of the Federales in Mexico. And his name was Arturo Durazo, and what he was, one, he was at that time one of the largest cocaine traffickers in Mexico. He was head of the Federales, and he was also the middleman between the CIA and the Contras for weapon shipments. And what Arturo did is that he set up some clandestine airstrips through Mexico so the CIA flights heading down could land if they needed, refuel if they needed, and then make their way in to deliver their arms. And coming back, they had a deal where he would load the planes up with drugs and they were flown back in. We knew that for a fact. We confirmed that with some CIA guys that we were working with on joint operations. And anyway, so that's what he was doing. And obviously, it's completely illegal on a number of fronts. But after I had a meeting in the desert one night, I came home, and this is just shortly after I interrogated Lawford. And as I was pulling up my house about right around midnight, a motorcycle pulls up next to me, empties what I was told was a machine pistol, probably a Ruger converted to full automatic .22, into the driver's side. And I saw that silhouette of a hand with a gun coming at me just before the shot went off. And I just jerked the car to the right, hit the brakes, and I went down a dirt embankment, and I could hear the popping, bang, 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 like that, very rapid. And before the car came to a rest in this dirt field, I jumped out because I didn't want to be stuck in a car, because it's like being in a rolling coffin. And when I jumped out, however I twisted and hit, I damaged my spinal cord, and I just couldn't move my legs at that stage. And they were numb, and all I remember hearing was some guy running through the brush, because it was heavy brush towards me, and I thought it was the shooter coming to finish me off. I had a gun strapped to my leg, a little 2-inch 38, but I couldn't reach it, and I just knew that was the enemy. I just thought, this is the shooter coming to finish me off. Well, it wasn't, fortunately. It was a fireman who lived nearby, and he heard the crash. But from that time forward, as soon as I got, they took me to a trauma center, and they're treating me, my lieutenant shows up, and he says, okay, here's what I want you to do. And, I'm laying on a gurney, right, in the emergency room. Mm-hmm. He says, when the guys get here from Huntington Beach, they're going to do the investigation. Don't tell them anything you're doing. Don't tell them anything about Durazo. Don't tell them anything about this. Don't tell them anything about that. And I go, what? What are you talking about? Somebody just tried to kill me, and you're telling me to lie to the investigators? And being a good cop at the time, following direction, I asked him why. He says, I'll tell you later. And he says, part of the reason, he says, those guys, we know they're in the pocket of the mafia, the Huntington Beach detectives. I was dealing with them, not the same guys, some other detectives there on some other cases, and I thought, this is friggin' nuts. And so it just continued that way, and it was just a huge onslaught of LAPD trying to crush the story that I could release. And matter of fact, they had such power with the media. Here it is, you have an undercover cop being ambushed at his house, right? And not, you think that would make the newspaper be a major story?
Certainly.
Yeah, never certainly. Appeared in anything. They kept it out of the media. And then it just got very, very strange what they started doing and ordering me to do. And they burglarized, which was interesting. They burglarized our house twice because they were obviously very worried that I had documents that would sink them, meaning the chief of police and, you know, possibly the Contra thing at the time. And
sure.
Yeah, they broke in twice. One time was rather interesting because they conspired with the local PD because I was 350 miles away. And this isn't just weeks. This went on for about 18 months, 2 years after this Jeez. Stuff was going on. And I was at 350 miles away with some people. My wife was at work. The local police go to our house, and there's a detective unit there, and it just happened to be that there's a retired LA cop living down the street, and he's watching this. He says he sees them talk to the guy in the patrol car. He drives away. They walk to the side of our house, break in the bedroom window, sets off the alarm, and he says within a minute or so the alarm was deactivated. Well, the only person who knew how to deactivate the alarm was my former partner in intelligence, who helped me install it. And so my attorney, because I already filed suit against LAPD, contacts the chief of police in Huntington Beach, says, okay, this is what happened. He says, well, you know what happened? We got a 911 call from that house, and the person said they're going to kill themselves, and then the person hung up. She goes, okay. He says, then we called back, meaning the PD called back, and the person picked up the phone and just hung it up. That sure. supposedly came from our house, right? Well, the right. only living thing that was at our house was a puppy we had that was in yeah. the yard, wasn't in the yeah. house. So that was the excuse to break in. But they sure. didn't break in. It was LAPD who broke in. And later, a guy from OCID came to me, and he said, here are the guys who broke in your house, and this is why. And they were looking. They were terrified that I had documents. And so that happened. Also, some intelligence guys, when I was still in the hospital in a private room under obviously an assumed name and so forth, guarded, they came in and they told me that, yes, I was the target of the assassination, but my wife was also targeted to be assassinated.
Oh, wow.
And obviously I'm going, what are you guys talking about? What's the deal? And they said, well, basically what I was told is that there were some very powerful people who were very concerned with what I knew, what I might do regarding the Contras at the time, because that's what DeRosa was involved in. And the Contra, mm-hmm. the whole Contra thing hadn't come out in the media yet. And so the deal was that the person who shot it, tried to kill me, was already back in Nicaragua the following day, and that my wife was targeted because they wanted to send a message, a very strong message, that anybody trying to interfere with this was going to be killed because yeah. it was such a huge narcotic trafficking thing, too. And that would have sent a message to everybody. A cop and his wife get assassinated. But, yeah, it was very bizarre, very bizarre. And it's a long story, but, you know, it was a frightening story at the time.
Back to Marilyn.
Sure.
It is interesting that you write about the incredible relationship that LAPD with OCID and its leaders, and to protect the Kennedys from their own indiscretions and the knowledge that was basically everyone knew. about their interactions with Marilyn Monroe. It's very interesting, too, when you talk about how serious they were to keep a lid on this when you write about Dorothy Kilgallen, a columnist, and what happens with her. It seems that there is some, again, overreach by government here, or that they intervene and have something to do with Dorothy's demise.
They very well may have. And what you have to do is look at how the country or the world events at the time, and the power that the president had, and considering what was going on with the Soviet Union and Cuba and so forth. And then you look at the background of the Kennedys at that time, which I've written another book about assassinations that they were authorizing of different leaders and different generals and different militaries around the world. And so you see that, and you say, okay, were there, they were authorizing the CIA to kill these various people, and some of them were leaders of various countries. Would they hesitate at killing an actress? You know, and the answer would be, who's expendable then, the president or Marilyn? And it would be Marilyn. What is interesting, though, is why Robert actually came out that night and met with her and gave her that drink, whatever's in it, why he did that. But I think from reading all the intelligence on it, is that they were so concerned she was going to go public so quickly, they had to do that just to keep her from going public. But at the time, there were other ways they could have handled her. They could have got any psychiatrist, and they would have just committed her to a mental institution. It was very easy to do back then. And they would have just drugged her up, kept her in there for 6 months or a year. And then when they released her, no matter what she said, they would go, oh, poor Marilyn, she's lost her mind. You know, she's in an institution, using a lot of drugs there. She's just completely confused about the world. It didn't have to be done the way it was.
Yeah. You basically, it seems that the conclusion is that because she was talking about doing this press conference in a few days, and that she, and they, according to what you read, is that Kennedy asked, what do you want? And so she was could not be reconciled here, and what she wanted and what Kennedy wanted. And so there was, had to have this murder occur.
There's only one way out at that stage. And obviously she didn't understand it, but other people understood it. And obviously there was, it was planned out, because otherwise Hamilton and the other guy from OCID would not have showed up at her doorstep at that time of night. It just wouldn't, it never would have happened. And so there was some pre-planning on that, if it went to that point. And, you know, Lawford was very good about being truthful. Watching him, I'm absolutely convinced he had no prior knowledge of this, what was going to happen to her. And without question, I believe that guilt followed him for the rest of his life, got him heavily into drugs and alcohol. It really destroyed the man carrying that burden. And I know he blamed them, but he never really came out and said it. And I know when he was dying, that's probably about 2 or 3 years after I interrogated him, he was in the hospital dying. And some reporters were there. They said, tell us about you and Marilyn and Robert. And he refused to talk about it. He wouldn't talk about it even then. But it's just, you know, it's just, the whole story is just very sad.
Yeah. It was great police work that you decided to, you know, even though he didn't agree to anything like that, that you just raised it up a notch and interrogated him, where it started off as a conversation, he believed, but it turned into the interrogation that got us the information that is the core of this book. An incredible revelation it was. Yeah.
Exactly.
I want to thank you very much, Mike Rothmiller, for coming on and talking about your latest bombshell, The Night Bobby Kennedy Killed Marilyn Monroe. I know that you're all over Amazon with all your other previous work, and how might anyone else find out about this book?
Well, Bombshell right now would be Amazon and Barnes & Noble, and there are probably hundreds of, if not thousands of bookstores that could be ordered through, but I would recommend just going to Amazon.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Mike Rothmiller. It has been an absolute delight. Bombshell, The Night Bobby Kennedy Killed Marilyn Monroe. You have a great evening. Thank you so much for this interview.
You too. You're welcome. Thank you.
Good night.